Captain Sullivan? The shift supervisor said in surprise. I didn't expect you this afternoon, sir.
I know.
The captain looked a little distracted, possibly even a little pale, the supervisor thought, but he spoke with his usual courtesy.
I just thought I'd drop by.
The supervisor's expression must have given him away, because Sullivan shook his head with a chuckle which might have sounded just a bit forced if someone had been listening for it.
Not because I think anything's wrong. I just like to look things over once in a while.
Of course, sir. Let me...
Oh, I see you already have slippers.
Yes. Sullivan looked down at the felt slippers on his feet. They were a little dirty and tattered-looking, the supervisor thought.
I thought it would be simpler to leave my boots in my office, since I had these lying around in one of my desk drawers, the captain explained,
and the supervisor nodded.
Of course, sir.
Do you want an escort?
I believe I'm adequately familiar with the facility, Sullivan said dryly.
Of course, I didn't mean...
Don't worry about it, Lieutenant. Sullivan patted him lightly on the arm. I didn't think you did.
Yes, sir. The supervisor stood respectfully to escort Sullivan out of his office. He accompanied the captain into the anteroom and waited until Sullivan had left, then turned to one of his clerks. Like everyone who worked in the powder mill proper, the clerk was already in slippers, and the supervisor twitched his head after the vanished captain.
Quick, Parker. Nip around the side and warn Lieutenant Marston Captain Sullivan's on his way.
Yes, sir.
The clerk dashed out of the anteroom, and the supervisor returned to his own office, wondering what bee had gotten into the old man's bonnet. It wasn't like the perpetually efficient, always well-organized Captain Sullivan to just drop by this way. The supervisor was just settling into his chair once again when he, his clerks, Captain Sullivan, and the 103 other men currently working in Powder Mill No. 3 all died in a monstrous blast of fire and fury. A chain of explosions rolled through the powder mill like Langhorne's own Rakurai, rattling every window in Herratha. Debris vomited into the sky, much of it on fire, trailing smoke in obscenely graceful arcs as it soared outward, then came crashing down in fresh fire and ruin. It shattered barracks and administrative buildings like an artillery bombardment, setting more fires, maiming and killing. Voices screamed, and stunned men wheeled towards the disaster in disbelief. Then alarm bells began a frenzied clangor, and the men who'd frozen in shock ran frantically into the fire and chaos and the devastation, looking for lives to save. 11 minutes later, magazines 6, 7, and 8 exploded as well.
It's not looking any better, is it?
Caleb Armagh's voice was flat and hard, and Prince Narman shook his head. The two of them sat in a private sitting room located off the room which had been Caleb's grandfather's library. That library, added to generously by King Harald, had long since outgrown the chamber and been moved to larger quarters, and Caleb had had the old library converted into a working office near the Imperial Suite. Now he and Narman sat looking out the windows which faced north, out across the waterfront and the blue expanse of Howell Bay, in the general direction of Big Tyrian Island. They didn't actually see the bay, however. Big Tyrian was almost 600 miles from where they sat, but both of them were gazing at the imagery relayed from Owl's snarks.
"I don't think it is going to look any better," Narman said quietly, looking at the shattered, smoking hole and the demolished buildings around it, which had been one of the Empire's largest and most important powder mills, and shook his head sadly.
"I think all we can do is bury the dead and rebuild from scratch."
"I know." It was obvious the financial cost of rebuilding was the least of Caleb's concerns at this moment. He shook his own head, the movement choppier and angrier than Narman's headshake had been.
We've been so lucky about avoiding this kind of accident. I just can't believe we've let something like this happen.
We didn't, Narman said. And Caleb looked at him sharply as he heard the iron in the Emeraldian prince's voice.
What do you mean? The emperor asked sharply.
I mean, this didn't just happen, Your Majesty. And it wasn't an accident either.
Narman met his gaze, his normally mild brown eyes hard.
It was deliberate. An act of sabotage.
You're not serious.
Indeed I am, Your Majesty.
Narman's voice was grim. We may never be able to prove it, but I'm positive in my own mind.
Caleb pushed back in his armchair and regarded his Imperial Counselor for Intelligence narrowly. No one else in Tellisburg, aside from the other members of the Inner Circle, knew anything about the disaster at Hayratha, and no one would until sometime the next day. That rather restricted the number of people with whom they could discuss it. But Michael Stainer, his younger brother Edward Hausmann, and Bin Zamin Reis were all listening in over their comms.
Bin Zamin, the Emperor said now. I'm not certain, Your Majesty, Baron Wave Thunder replied. I think I see what Prince Narman is getting at, though.
Which is? Caleb prompted.
It's the delay in the magazine explosions, isn't it, Your Highness? Wave Thunder said by way of reply.
That's exactly what I'm thinking about, Narman agreed grimly. He looked at Caleb. Nobody, not even Owl, was watching when this happened. Perhaps that's an oversight we'd like to rectify in the future. Although I realize we're already taxing even his capabilities with the number of snarks we've got deployed. Because we weren't watching, we'll never be able to reconstruct the events leading up to it, not accurately, and not anything like completely. But there was a significant delay between the main explosion in the powder mill itself and the explosions in the magazines. I'm no expert on the way powder's handled and stored in the mills or what their standard safety measures may be, but I'd be surprised if it was easy for an explosion in one magazine to touch off an explosion in another one. And if that's true, it should certainly have been difficult for an explosion in the mill to cause any of the magazines to explode, far less three of them. Yet that's exactly what happened. And it didn't happen simultaneously, which is what I would have expected if it had been a sympathetic detonation, and all of that suggests to me that the explosions were deliberately arranged with some sort of timer.
Owl?
Yes, Your Majesty,
the distant AI said politely.
I know you weren't watching Big Tyrion or Hayratha, but did any of your snarks pick up the explosions, and if so, how close together did they come?
In answer to your first question, Your Majesty, yes, the comm relay above the cauldron did detect the explosions. In answer to your second question, the powder production facility itself was destroyed by 7 distinct explosions, occurring over a period of approximately 11 seconds. Each magazine was destroyed by a single primary explosion, followed by a chain of secondary detonations. The first magazine was destroyed approximately 11 minutes and 17 seconds after the first detonation in the powder production facility. The second magazine was destroyed 37 seconds after that. The third was destroyed 3 minutes and 9 seconds after the second one.
Caleb and Narman looked at one another, and Dominic Stainer swore softly over the calm.
I think Narman's right, Your Majesty, Hausmann said quietly. It had to be some kind of timing mechanism, at least in the magazines. I don't know what kind of timer. It could have been something as simple as a lit candle shoved into a powder cask and allowed to burn down, but I think that's the only explanation for how they could have come that long after the main explosion, but still have been sequenced that closely.
Damn. Caleb shoved up out of his chair and crossed to the window, folding his arms across his chest, while he stared out towards the invisible island and the pall of smoke still hanging above it.
"How did they get in?" "We'll probably never know, Your Majesty," Naaman told him heavily. "Obviously our security measures weren't stringent enough after all, though."
"I don't see how we could make them much tighter, Your Highness," Waif Thunder objected. "We've always recognized the powder mills would be a priority target for any temple loyalist intent on seriously damaging us. We've got round-the-clock marine sentries on the gates and every building, and the magazines themselves are kept locked, except when powder's actually being transferred. Keys to the locks are held only by the mill's commanding officer and the current officer of the watch. When powder transfers are ordered, they're always overseen by a commissioned officer with a marine security and safety detachment, and additional keys have to be signed out individually by that officer, who's also responsible for their return. And when any of the magazines are opened for transfers, we have sentries on all the other magazines as well. Beyond that, nobody's allowed into the facility unless he actually works there or has clear, verified authorization for his visit. Any visitors accompanied at all times by someone assigned to the mill, and regular and random patrols sweep the perimeter fence.
"My comment wasn't a criticism, Bin Zamin," Naaman said, "simply an observation. Whether we can make them tighter or not, they obviously weren't sufficiently tight to prevent what just happened. I do think it would be a good idea to assign at least a couple of remotes to each of our remaining powder mills, though. We might not have been able to do anything quickly enough to prevent what happened at Hayratha, even if Owl had been watching and realized something was amiss before the explosions. But at least we'd be in a much better position after the fact to figure out what actually did happen and who was responsible for it. And that might put us in a better position to keep it from happening again."
"You think it's part of an organized operation?" Caleb asked. "That they may attempt to blow up our other powder mills as well?"
"I don't know," Naaman shook his head, eyes intent as he considered the question. "All it would really take would be one truly convinced temple loyalist in the wrong place. For all we know, that's what happened here. The fact that some sort of timer was used may indicate we're looking at the work of a single individual or a small number of individuals. Or it may not indicate anything of the sort. Perhaps it was a larger group that used timers for all four of the primary explosions so its members could get out again. If it was a larger group, that would seem to up the chances of additional similar attempts. We just don't know. But I don't see where keeping a closer eye on the remaining mills could hurt anything, and it might just help quite a lot."
"Agreed," Caleb nodded. "Owl, please implement Prince Naaman's suggestion and assign sufficient remotes to keep all of our remaining powder mills under observation."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
"Thank you," Caleb said, and Houseman sighed heavily over the link.
"What is it, Edward?"
"I was just thinking that, terrible as this is from every perspective, it gets even worse when I think about Irvin's having walked into the middle of it, Your Majesty," the Iron Master said heavily. "It's going to devastate Alfred when he finds out. For that matter, it's hitting me damned hard. But that's from a purely personal, selfish viewpoint. We needed him. Needed him pushing the envelope and constantly coming up with new ideas, like that breech-loading rifle of his."
"I know," Caleb sighed. "I know."
He shook his head.
"And speaking of personal viewpoints, think about his family. They didn't lose just him, but his cousin too."
He shook his head again, his expression hard.
"I want the people responsible for planning this. I want them badly."
"Then we'll just have to see what we can do about finding them for you, Your Majesty," Prince Naaman said.
5. Shakim, Princedom of Tanshah.
All right, you lazy bastards, on your feet. Your little pleasure cruise just came to an end.
Sir Gwilym Manther's head twitched up at the raucous chorus of shouts. He could see virtually nothing in the hot, stinking tween-deck space, but he heard the thud of hammers as the wedges which secured the hatch battens were driven out. Boots clumped and thumped on the deck overhead. Other voices bawled orders, and heavy chain rattled metallically in the darkness around him.
"I guess I really can sleep just about anywhere," he thought. "Must be Shakim. About time, even for this tub."
He knew very little about Shakim beyond the name, only that it was the major seaport of the Princedom of Tanshah, and that it lay across the 450-mile-wide mouth of the Gulf of Tanshah, from Gerlas in the Duchy of Fern, the most northwesterly of Dolar's provinces. If this was Shakim, they were officially in West Haven, little more than 500 miles from the Temple Lands border and 1,400 miles from Lake Pay.
"Sir?"
The voice was faint, barely audible, and his right hand gently stroked the matted hair of the head lying in his lap.
"It seems we're here, Master Sversman."
He kept his own voice as close to normal as he could, but it was hard when the boy's bony hand reached up and gripped his wrist.
"I imagine we're going to have some light in a few minutes." "Can't come too soon for me, sir,"
the midshipman said gamely. He grunted with effort, shoving himself up into a sitting position, and Manthea heard a retching sound. It went on for several seconds before it stopped.
"Sorry about that, sir,"
Sversman said.
"You're not the only one who's fouled himself down here, Master Sversman," Manthea told him. "Not your fault, either. Chain a man where he can't move and leave him there long enough, and it's going to happen."
"True enough, Sir Gwilym." Captain Michael Kruger's voice came out of the dark.
"And just think how much fun these bastards are going to have washing down all this shit, if you'll pardon the expression, sir, once we're out of here."
The man who'd captained HMS Avalanche sounded positively cheerful at the thought, and Manthea heard other laughter from men he couldn't see.
"There is that bit in the writ about reaping what you sow, Cap'n," someone else observed. "And shit for shitheads is about right, to my way of thinking."
There was more laughter, and then the first batten was thrown aside and bright morning sunlight streamed down into the cavernous, stinking hold.
"Hold your noise, you fucking scum," someone shouted. "Keep shut if you know what's good for you."
"Why?"
a Carisian voice shot back derisively.
"What are you going to do? Tell the Grand Inquisitor on us?"
Laughter hooted in the stinking hold, and Manthea's heart swelled with weeping pride in his men.
"Think it's funny, do you?"
the voice which had shouted snarled.
"We'll see how you like it in a month or so."
Manthea looked around him, squinting his eyes against the light as more battens were heaved aside. Niklas Valaine lay beside him, blinking groggily. Manthea didn't like the valet's sunken cheeks and hollow eyes. Valaine was 10 years older than he was, and he had started without the inherent toughness a life at sea had given Manthea. No man in the world could have more courage and spirit, but Valaine's body was beginning to fail him. Beyond Valaine, as the light explored their fetid prison, he saw other scarecrows, many of them lying in pools of their own filth. Dysentery was stalking among them, taking its own toll, and his heart was grimly certain that at least some of those still lying motionless would never move again. When he thought about it, it was almost a miracle so many of them were still alive. The 6 5-days since they'd left Gorath had been the most brutal and crushing of Manthea's life, and that was saying something for a Carisian seaman. But then, whatever men might say, the sea was never truly cruel. She simply didn't care. It took men to practice cruelty, men who deliberately and knowingly gave themselves to cruelty's service, and it didn't matter whether they claimed to do it in the name of God or the name of Shan Wei herself. What mattered was the sickness and the hunger and the perversion eating away whatever it was inside them that might once have made them truly human. Things had gotten a little better after Twingith. Manthea didn't really know why, although he'd come to the conclusion they probably owed at least some of it to Father Merton. The fair-haired young upper priest seemed no less fervent in his faith than Victor Tarlson, and Manthea doubted Father Merton would hesitate to put any heretic to the question or to the punishment. The difference between him and Tarlson was that Tarlson would enjoy it. Father Merton would simply do it because that was what his beliefs required of him. Manthea couldn't decide which of those was actually worse when he came down to it. But at least Father Merton didn't delight in the sort of small-souled brutality which had killed almost a dozen of Manthea's men in the first 5 day and a half of this nightmare journey.
"Oh, stop trying to analyze things, Gwillem," he told himself. "You know perfectly well what it really was. Even that asshole Tarlson finally realized none of you were going to live the rest of the way to Zion if he kept it up. Pity he figured it out. It would have been so fitting for him to have to face Clintan and explain how he'd come to use up all of the grand asshole's heretics before he got home with them. Hell, he'd probably have gotten to take our place."
He let himself dwell for a moment or two on the delightful image of Tarlson facing his own Inquisition, then brushed it aside. Whether Tarlson faced justice in this life or the next really didn't matter. Face it he would, one way or the other. And for now, duty called, and duty and fidelity to his men were really all he had left.
"Wakey, wakey, Niklas,"
he called as cheerily as he could, shaking the valet gently.
"They say our cruise is over. Back on the road again, I suppose."
"Yes, sir."
Valet shook himself, struggling gamely up into a sitting position and fastidiously straightening the remaining rags of his clothing.
"I'll see to making reservations at a decent hotel, sir."
"You do that," Manthea said affectionately, resting one hand on the older man's slight shoulder.
"Nothing but the best, mind you. Clean linen and warming pans for me and Master Sversman. And be sure you pick the wine. Can't trust my judgment about that, you know."
"Of course, sir."
Valaine managed a death's head smile, and Manthea squeezed his shoulder before he turned back to Sversman. The midshipman smiled too, but it looked even more ghastly on him. Valaine was over 60. Lancier Sversman was not yet 13, and 13-year-old boys, even 13-year-old boys who were kings, officers, weren't supposed to be one-legged, hollow-cheeked and sunken-eyed, half-starved, racked by fever and nausea, and filled with the knowledge of what awaited all of them. 3 temple guardsmen clattered down the steep ladder from the upper deck. Manthea was pretty sure they'd been chosen for their duty as punishment for some lapse in duty, and he heard them gagging on the stench despite the bandanas tied across their noses and mouths. 3 days locked in the hold of an undersized coasting brig tended to produce quite an aroma, he thought grimly.
"On your feet," one of them snarled. "You there."
He kicked one of the seamen lying closest to the hatch.
"You first."
He tossed the seaman a key, then stood back, tapping the 2-foot truncheon in his right hand against the side of his boot while the Carisian fumbled with the padlock. He managed to get it open, and iron grated and rattled as the chain which had been run through ring bolts on the deck and then through the irons on every man's ankles was released. He pushed himself clumsily to his still-chained feet and staggered towards the ladder.
"Get a move on, whore son," the guardsman sneered, prodding him viciously with the truncheon.
Can't be late for your date in Zion."
The Corisian almost fell, but he caught himself on the ladder with his manacled hands and climbed slowly and painfully up it, while the cursing guardsmen kicked and cuffed and beat his fellows to their feet. They made no distinction between officer, non-com, and enlisted, and neither did the Corisians any more. Those distinctions had been erased in the face of their common privation, and all that remained were Corisians, doing whatever they could to help their companions survive another day.
"Which is stupid of us,"
Manthea thought, as he forced himself to his feet, and then bent to half-assist and half-lift young Sversman.
"All we're doing is prolonging our own punishment until we get to Zion. If we had any sense, we'd figure out how to hang ourselves tonight."
That dark thought had come to him with increasing frequency, and he braced himself against its seduction while he slipped his arm around Sversman's shoulders and helped him towards the ladder. However tempting it might be, it wasn't for him. Not while a single one of his men lived. There might not be one damn thing he could do for any of them, but one thing he couldn't do was to abandon them. And they, the miserable, starving, sick, gutsy bastards that they were, would never give the Inquisition the satisfaction of giving up.
August, Year of God, 895. 1. Royal Palace, City of Talkeira, Kingdom of Delphirac.
"I could wish they'd just go ahead and get all of this settled,"
King Zaimes II grumbled across the dinner table.
The king's kingdom, despite its respectable size, was not one of the great realms of Safehold. In fact, it was on the penurious side, which was one reason his own father had arranged his marriage to one of Hector of Coruscant's cousins. King Stiven had had hopes that the relatively wealthy island princedom would see its way to make investments in his longed-for project to turn the port city of Farad into the kernel for a Delphiracan merchant marine which, in alliance with that of Coruscant, might actually have been capable of challenging Karis's maritime dominance. Alas, it had never been any more than a hope, a dream, really, although Prince Franz, and later Hector, had been relatively generous in loans over the years.
Not that Zaimes had entertained any illusions, that it had been out of the goodness of Hector's heart,
whatever might have motivated his father. Hector of Coruscant had always invested his marks wisely,
and it had been Zaimes Oliver Reynaud's distant kinship to an up-and-coming bishop of the Order of Shula which had been the true reason for Hector's generosity. Not that Willem Reynaud had ever done a damned thing for Delphirac, Zaimes reflected grumpily. He'd been willing enough to use Zaimes as a go-between to Hector once or twice, and he'd helped arrange the remittance of the interest on a couple of the king's more pressing loans from the temple, but that was about it.
And now there was this mess.
"Sooner or later it will all blow over, I'm sure, dear,"
Queen Consort Halen said serenely from her own side of the table. The two of them dined alone together more often than not, less for any deep romantic reasons than because state dinners were expensive. At the moment, their three grown sons were elsewhere, no doubt entertaining themselves in some fashion of which a dutiful mother would not have approved. The Queen Consort had grown increasingly accustomed to that over the years. In fact, she had grown accustomed to a great many things and taken most of them placidly in stride.
"Ha!" Zaimes shook his head.
Then, for added emphasis, he shook his finger across the table as well.
"Ha! You mark my words, Halen. This is going to get still worse before it gets better. And we're already stuck in the middle of it, no thanks to dear, distant cousin Willem."
Hush. Few things could disturb Queen Halen's even-tempered world but her husband's occasional criticisms of Mother Church, and especially of the Inquisition, were among them. She looked around the dining room, then relaxed as she realized there'd been no servants to hear the injudicious remark.
"Saying things like that isn't going to help, dear.
she said, more severely than she normally spoke to her royal spouse. "And I really wish you'd be a little more sparing with them, especially," she looked straight across the table, "these days."
Zames grimaced, but he didn't protest, which was itself a sign of the times.
Despite the distant nature of his relationship to the Archbishop of Chiangwu, he had never cherished many illusions about the inner workings of the vicarate. There'd been times when he'd been hard put to visualize exactly how those workings could serve the interests of God, but he'd been wise enough to keep his nose out of matters that were none of his affair. Until, of course, his wife's cousin dumped his two surviving children into Zaim's lap, and simultaneously dumped the king into the temple's business right up to his royal neck. It had seemed like a situation with no downside when Hector first requested asylum for his daughter and younger son. The request had come with promises of a very attractive subsidy in return for the king's hospitality, and given the fact that Hector had become the temple's anointed paladin in its struggle against the Carisian heretics, it had offered Zaims an opportunity to cement his relations with that dratted, distant kinsman of his as well. It wasn't likely to make his relationship with Caris any worse either, given that business in Farade. And in a worst-case situation, from Hector's perspective that was, it would give Zaims physical control of the rightful ruler of Coruscant. Best of all, he'd had absolutely no responsibility for getting the royal refugees to Tal'Kyrra. All he'd had to do was offer them reasonable quarters, or as close to it as the old-fashioned fortress of his palace permitted, if they succeeded in getting there. Then Hector managed to lose his war against Caris and to get himself assassinated. Suddenly Zaims found himself in the middle of what looked like turning into a nasty situation. On the one hand, he was forced to recognize, or at least deal with, Prince Davin's regency council in Coruscant, despite the fact that it had signed a peace treaty with Caelib and Charlian of Caris and sworn to abide by its terms. Vicar Zamzin, speaking as Chancellor Trinair, had made Mother Church's position on the legitimacy of that council abundantly clear. But at least he'd recognized certain pragmatic constraints on Zaim's position and stopped short of threatening the king for his dealings with the proscribed council. On the other hand, Vicar Zaspar, speaking as Grand Inquisitor Clintan, had made it equally abundantly clear Zaims dared not give any formal recognition to the Regency Council, which forced him to squirm through all sorts of convoluted hoops, just figuring out how to phrase his correspondence with it. Yet, simultaneously, both Vicar Zamzin and Vicar Zaspar had informed him, speaking as lords of the temple lands, that they very much desired for him to retain physical custody of young Davin for the foreseeable future. Zaims often found himself wondering exactly why that was. Surely the boy would be safer in the temple's direct custody in Zion, where no Carisian assassin could get at him. And if the temple intended someday to restore him to his father's throne, then wouldn't it have made more sense to see to it that he was trained up from childhood in a spirit of proper respect for and obedience to Mother Church in Mother Church's own imperial city? The contemplation of those questions had led him to certain unhappy conclusions. Indeed, to conclusions unhappy enough that he hadn't shared them even with his wife. "I'm just saying," he said now, "that we're in a sticky situation and this squabbling and bloodshed isn't going to make it any better. Langhorn only knows how the Carisians are going to react when those prisoners Ranild captured get to Zion, but it's not going to be pretty. We've had our own demonstration of that, haven't we?" His wife frowned, the way she always did whenever someone alluded to the Farade massacre. She had never been happy about the part Delphiracan troops had played in the original incident, and despite what she had said a moment ago, she had had some tart words of her own for the Inquisition following the murders. The Empire of Caris' reprisal against the city hadn't made her one bit happier, although she recognized that the Carisians had actually been rather restrained in their response, however it had been reported by the Inquisition.
"We're lucky they've been too busy elsewhere to go on raiding our coasts," Zames continued. "But that can always change, especially now that they've settled things with Taro. Everything they had committed to blockading Gorgia is available for other enterprises now, you know. And leaving that completely aside, the more settled things get in Coruscant, the more awkward they're likely to get for us here in Tal'Kyra."
It was the closest he'd yet come to broaching his suspicions about who'd really murdered Prince Hector and his older son. From the flicker in Halen's eyes, she might have been entertaining a few of those same suspicions herself. "This Regency Council of young Davins is starting to sound far too conciliatory where Kairos is concerned for my peace of mind," he continued, deliberately steering the conversation to one side. "I'm not sure how much longer Vicar Zamsin's going to go on allowing me to correspond with them. And what do we do about Davin then?" He shook his head. "The most likely outcome I can see is for the temple to take him into its direct custody." Halen's eyes widened, and one hand rose to the base of her throat. "Whatever else Davin and Iris may be, they're my cousins," she said. "And prince or not, Davin's only a little boy, Zames. He only turns 11 next 5 day, and Iris isn't even 19 yet. They need family, especially after all they've already been through." "I know," Zames said more gently,
"and I'm fond of them myself. But if the vicarate..."
He saw her grimace slightly, proof both of them knew he was actually speaking about the group of four. "Decide we've gotten too cozy with the Regency Council, and if they decide the Regency Council's gotten too cozy with Kairos, that's exactly what they're likely to do. And in the meantime, they're more or less ordering me to go on corresponding with the Regency Council. And they're insisting on receiving true copies of every document from the Regency Council to me or to Kairos. So if anyone in Manthea commits anything indiscreet to writing, that's likely to come home to roost here in Tal'Kyra as well." "Surely they've realized that as well as you do, dear."
"Is they the Regency Council? Kairos? Or the Vicarate?"
Zames inquired, just a bit caustically, and her brief, unhappy smile acknowledged his point.
"Well, I suppose all we can do is the best we can do," he continued. "I'd prefer not to have made an enemy out of Kairos in the first place, but since it's a little late to do anything about that, I think we'll just concentrate on keeping our heads down and staying out of their line of fire. As far as Davin and Iris are concerned, we're just going to have to go on playing it by ear, Halen. I don't say I like it, and I don't say I'll be happy if the decision is made to take them out of our custody, but it's not as if we'll have a lot of choice if that happens." "And," he added silently as his wife nodded unhappily, "as much as I don't wish them any ill fortune, it would still be a vast relief to see them somewhere else, somewhere where no one could possibly blame me for whatever happens to them."
"So what do we do with this one?" Sir Clement Halidrone asked dourly.
"I presume we go ahead and deliver it to the boy," Fastair Layman, Baron of Lakeland and First Counsellor of the Kingdom of Delphirac, replied.
"Why? Does it contain anything dangerous?"
"Nothing, except 6 of the biggest, nastiest-looking wyverns I've seen in a while," Halidrone replied. "I went through it pretty carefully, you can be sure, but I didn't see anything else out of the ordinary about it."
As the palace's chief chamberlain, he'd seen his share of bizarre royal gifts over the years, and he'd seldom paid much attention to them, if the truth be told. That was no longer true, however, and he'd looked this one over closely.
"Wyverns?" Lakeland repeated, eyebrows arching. "All the way from Coruscant?"
All the way from Coruscant, Halidrom confirmed. According to the cover note, they're a gift from Duke Anville Rock for the boy's birthday. Apparently he was just starting to fly his own wyverns for small game before his father packed him off to us. The Chamberlain chuckled. Be a few years before he's ready to fly any of these, though. The damn things are big enough to pick him up and fly away. Lakeland shook his head with a bemused smile. Worrying about the gift someone might send a boy for his 11th birthday wasn't something which concerned most First Counselors. Of course, most First Counselors weren't in Lakeland's position. Bishop Executor Dinsale Vaspar had made it abundantly clear that he was to be kept fully informed about anything which was delivered to Prince Davin or any other member of his household. Bishop Mitchell Zessop, Vaspar's intendant, had made it equally clear he intended to hold Lakeland personally responsible for the completeness of those reports. The whole thing struck the Baron as excessive, to say the least. Anybody who tried to poison the boy, for example, was unlikely to do it by sending him sweetmeats from Coruscant, and that was the most likely threat he could imagine. Well, the most likely threat from anything anyone might openly send him, at any rate, Lakeland amended a bit more grimly. Still, Halidrom might have a point about this particular gift. It seemed evident the boy had to take after his mother, since by all reports Hector of Coruscant had been a tall, powerfully built fellow, and Prince Davin was never going to be a large man. 3 days short of his 11th birthday, he was a small, slender boy. Not delicate, just small, with a wiry knit frame that seemed unlikely to ever bulk up with muscle. He was smart, too, almost as smart as that sister of his, and Lakeland suspected that under normal circumstances he probably would have been a lively handful. As it was, he was quiet, often pensive, and he spent a lot of time with his books. Partly that was a natural consequence of the King Wyvern's Eye, his sister, King Zaim's guardsman, and the members of his own household kept on him. Given what had happened to his father and his older brother, that sort of suffocating surveillance was inevitable, but it had to have a depressing effect on a lad's natural high spirits and sense of mischief. Perhaps that was why neither Lakeland nor Halidrom had seen any sign of a passion for hunting wyverns in him. It wasn't as if he'd had any opportunity to pursue the sport since arriving here, after all.
"Did any other gifts arrive with them?" he asked.
"No," Halidrom shook his head, then made a face.
"Most of them got here a couple of 5 days ago, courtesy of that Carisian parole. These just arrived today, and I think they must have been an afterthought. Either that, or somebody figured the Carisians might not pass them through for some reason."
"Why do you say that?"
"Well, they're obviously from Anvil Rock. Most of the correspondence is in a secretary's hand, of course, but he sent along a nice little personal note to the boy, in his own handwriting, along with a list of devotional readings he'd like the lad to be studying now that he's getting older."
The Chamberlain shrugged.
"We've seen enough of his handwriting by now to know it's really his, and the secretary's writing matches the last several sets of letters we've received as well, but they didn't come covered by a Carisian guarantee of safe passage, the way the rest of the birthday gifts did." He chuckled. "In fact, they came upriver from Sarmouth by messenger, courtesy of a smuggler, unless I miss my guess."
"That's interesting." Lakeland rubbed his nose. "A smuggler, you say?"
"That's my best guess, at any rate," Halidrom shrugged. "I've got a fellow waiting outside if you'd like to speak to him directly."
"That might not be a bad idea," Lakeland said and smiled slightly.
"If the fellow's a smuggler, or knows somebody who is at any rate, we might even be able to get some decent whiskey through that damned blockade."
Halidrom chuckled, nodded, and departed. A few moments later he returned,
with a tall, brown-haired and brown-eyed man in the decent but nondescript dress of a seaman. If the stranger was worried as he was ushered into the First Counsellor's office, he hid it well.
"Abraham Zivons, my lord," Halidrom said, speaking rather more formally in the outsider's presence, and Zivons bobbed a respectful bow.
"So, Master Zivons," Lakeland said, "I understand you've come to deliver a birthday gift for Prince Davin."
"Aye, my lord, I have.
Or so Sir Clement tells me," Zivons shrugged. "Nobody told me the lad was a prince, you understand. Mind, it seemed likely he wasn't what you might be calling a common lad, given how much somebody was willing to pay to get his present delivered to him. And let me tell you, keeping those damned wyverns, begging your pardon, fed, without losing a finger, was a harder job than I'd figured on."
There was a twinkle in the brown eyes, and Lakeland felt his own lips hovering on the brink of a smile.
"So you brought them all the way from Coruscant, did you?" he asked.
"Oh, no, my lord. I made connections in Taro, as you might say. I've just helped them along the last leg."
"Smuggler, are you?"
The Baron allowed his expression to harden slightly.
This fellow might or might not be a smuggler, and he might or might not have known young Davin was a prince. And this struck the First Counsellor as an unlikely way to get an assassin into the boy's presence, for that matter. Still,
"That's a hard word."
Zivons didn't sound particularly hurt by it, however.
"I'm more of a free trader. I specialize in small cargoes for shippers who'd sometimes sooner avoid any unnecessary paperwork, as you might say. True, but my word's my bond. I always see to any delivery myself, you see, and my rates are reasonable, my lord."
He smiled charmingly.
"Very reasonable."
"Somehow I suspect your definition of reasonable and mine may differ just a bit," Lakeland said dryly.
"Oh, I'm sure we could come to an agreement suitable to both of us, always assuming you ever had need of my services, of course."
"Now that I can believe," Lakeland leaned back.
"I don't imagine you'd have access to any Chisholmian whisky, would you, Master Zivons?"
"No, not personally, I'm afraid. Not since the Grand Inquisitor went and declared his embargo, of course. Still, I'm sure I could lay hands on someone who does. Indirectly, of course."
"Oh, of course," Lakeland agreed. "Well, if you do manage it, I think I can safely say you'll find it worth your while to deliver some of it here in Talkeera."
"I'll bear that in mind, my lord."
Would it be too much of a disappointment to you if it was to arrive here without Telfarakan tax stamps?"
Zivon smiled winningly when Lakeland looked at him.
"It's not that I'm trying to rob you or your king of any rightful revenue, my lord. It's more a matter of principle, so to speak."
"I see." Lakeland's lips quivered.
"Very well, Master Zivons. I'm sure I'll be able to deal with my disappointment somehow."
"I'm glad to hear it, my lord."
Zivons bowed again politely, and Lakeland chuckled.
"If you can manage to stay unhanged long enough, you'll die a wealthy man, Master Zivons."
"Kind of you to be saying so, my lord, but it's my aim to live a wealthy man, if you take my meaning."
"Indeed I do."
Lakeland shook his head, then sobered a bit.
"I take it that you don't know exactly how this delivery got to Taro in the first place, though."
"I've no certain knowledge one way or the other, my lord, but I do know the fellow who brought it as far as Taro was a fine seaman, who somehow managed to forget to apply for his tax documents when he docked in Coruscant. Well, that's what I've heard, at any rate."
"And would this fellow have a name?" Lakeland pressed.
It was obvious Zivons didn't really like the thought of passing along any additional information.
Actually, that made Lakeland think the better of him, since it seemed to indicate a certain honour among thieves, or among smugglers at least. But the First Counsellor wasn't letting him off that lightly, and he sat silently, eyes boring into Zivon's, until finally the smuggler shrugged. "Harry's, my lord," he said with a slight but unmistakable emphasis, looking levelly back at the Baron. "Zol Harris." "Ah." Lakeland glanced quickly at Halidrom, then nodded to Zivon's. "I realize revealing professional confidences cuts against the grain of a free trader such as yourself, Master Zivon's. Nonetheless, I'm sure you understand why we have to exercise at least a little caution where people delivering unexpected gifts to Prince Davin are concerned." "Aye, I can see where that might be the case," Zivon's conceded. "Well, I believe that's all I really needed to discuss with you," Lakeland said. "I'm serious about the whiskey, though." "I'll bear that in mind, my lord," Zivon's assured him, and bowed again as Halidrom nodded at the door. "Wait for me in the hall for a moment, Master Zivon's," he said.
"Of course, my lord."
"Harry's, is it?" Lakeland murmured as the door closed behind the smuggler. "Interesting choice of delivery man, don't you think, Clement?"
"Yes, it is," the Chamberlain agreed. "I wonder why they didn't just send him all the way to Sarmath himself."
"Oh, come now," Lakeland shook his head. "Caleb and Narmon have had the better part of 2 years on the ground in Coruscant by now. I'd say there's a good chance they know exactly who Hector used to get the prince and his sister to the mainland. They'd probably really like the opportunity to have a few words with him, especially if Anvil Rock and Corus are still using him too. But they'd be looking for him here in Coruscant, not in Tarrow, of all places. So it would make sense for him to use somebody they've never heard of for the last leg."
"I suppose so," Halidrom agreed. "Of course, if it is Harry's, that makes this gift a bit more suspicious, don't you think?"
"It might, and it might not. My thought, though, is that since Prince Anvil Rock apparently had no problem getting permission to send Prince Davin's other birthday presents through the blockade, with Carizion approval, if there's anything suspicious about this gift, it's probably something he didn't want the Carizions to know about. You haven't found anything out of order about it?"
"Nothing." Halidrom shook his head. "I even had the wyverns moved into another cage while I checked the bottom of the one they came in for false partitions or compartments."
They looked at one another for a moment, while both of them considered the possibility of things like spoken messages, which would leave no inconvenient written records behind.
"Well, given the thoroughness of your examination, I think we simply make sure we've got copies of all the correspondence, then report its arrival to Bishop Mitchell, send him the copies, and pass it on to Duke Corus for Prince Davin," Lakeland decided. He leaned back in his chair again, meeting Halidrom's eyes. "And given the Lord Bishop's views on smugglers and the embargo, I see no need to describe our conversation with Master Zivon's to him, do you?"
"A gift from Duke Anvil Rock, is it, my lord?" Tobias Ramair cocked an eyebrow at Philip Asgood. "Would it happen the boy was expecting any additional gifts from him?"
"No, it wouldn't," the Duke of Corus replied. "Which is why it occurred to me that it might be as well for you and I to accept delivery before we let it or the delivery man into his presence."
"Oh, I can understand that," Raymare agreed. "Would you like me to ask one of the other lads to step in as well?"
"I doubt that will be necessary," Corus replied with a slight smile, considering the sword and dirk riding in well-worn sheaths at Raymare's side. "Not for one man, who's not even getting into the same room with the boy."
"As you say, my lord."
Raymare bowed, then crossed the room to open the door.
A tall, brown-haired man stepped through it, followed by two of the palace's servants, and Brother Baldwin Gamelin, one of King Zaim's junior secretaries. Between them, the wary footman carried an ornately gilded travelling cage, which contained six large wyverns. The wyverns gazed about with beady, unusually intelligent-looking eyes, and Corris frowned. It seemed an odd choice for a gift from Anvil Rock, who knew perfectly well that Davin had never showed the least interest in hunting wyverns. That had been his older brother's passion.
"Master Zivon's, is it?" Corris asked the brown-haired man.
"Aye, sir. Abraham Zivon's, at your service," the stranger replied in a pleasant tenor voice.
"And you're an associate of Captain Harry's?"
"Oh, I'd not go that far, my lord."
Zivon shook his head, but his eyes met Corris levelly.
"It's more that we're in the same line of business, so to speak. These days, at least."
"I see." Corris glanced at the footman and Brother Baldwin, who were waiting patiently, and wondered which of them was Baron Lakeland's ears for this conversation. Probably all three of them, he decided. Or perhaps one was Lakeland's, and one was Mitchell Zessop's.
"Did Captain Harry's pass on any messages to me?" he asked out loud.
"No, my lord. Can't say he did," Zivon's replied, "except that he did say as how you might be seeing me or one of my business associates with another odd delivery now and again."
He smiled easily, but his eyes held Corris' gaze intently.
"I think you might say the captain's of the opinion he might have become just a bit too well known to be serving you the way he has before."
"Yes, I suppose I might," Corris said thoughtfully and nodded. "Well, in that case, Master Zivon's, thank you for your efficiency." He reached into his belt pouch, withdrew a 5-mark piece, and flipped the golden disc to the smuggler, who caught it with an easy economy of movement and a grin. One of the footmen smiled as well, and Corris hoped the man had made note of the fact that there'd been absolutely no way for anything written to have been exchanged in the process. "I'm sure these fellows can see you safely on your way, Master Zivon's," he continued. "And I'm sure you can imagine there's a certain young man anxiously awaiting my report on what his mysterious birthday gift might be."
"Oh, that I can, my lord. I'd no idea he was a prince, of course, but I'm sure every boy that age is much the same under the skin."
The Earl smiled again and nodded, and Zivon sketched a bow and followed the footman and Brother Baldwin out. Corris watched the door close behind him, then turned to Raymer.
"And what do you make of our master Zivon's, Tobis?"
"Seems a capable sort, my lord," Raymer replied. "Never heard as how the boy, Prince Davin, I mean, was all that fond of wyvern hunting, howsomever."
"That's because he wasn't, and isn't," Corris murmured.
"You don't say," Raymer observed. "Now that makes a man feel just a mite suspicious. Especially arriving all unannounced this way, doesn't it just?"
"Perhaps. But Master Zivon says Captain Harry's got them as far as Taro," Corris said, lifting his eyes to Raymer's face. "Of course, by this time, it's entirely possible someone's figured out how we got here from Coruscant, so the fact that Zivon's claims he knows Harry's doesn't necessarily prove anything. It does strike me as an indicator in its favour, though. And then there's this." He pulled out the already opened envelope which had accompanied the travelling cage. It contained a sheaf of correspondence, and the Earl extracted the letters and showed them to Raymer. "I recognise the handwriting. Both Duke Anvil Rock's and his secretary's," he pointed out. He looked down at them for a moment, then shrugged and walked across to his bookcase.
He ran his finger down the spines of the shelved books until he found the one he wanted, then took it from the shelf, sat down at his desk, and unfolded Anvil Rock's letter to Davin. The chapter and verse notations Anvil Rock had included in his letter were exactly the sort to which a considerably older kinsman and a regent might want to direct a youthful charge's attention, especially if they had no opportunity for personal contact with the boy. A little somber and weighty for a lad Davin's age, perhaps, but the boy was the legitimate ruler of an entire princedom. Something a bit more serious than the sorts of verses most children memorized for catechism might well be in order, given those circumstances. Corris wasn't particularly interested in looking up the passages indicated to check their content, however. Instead, he was turning pages in the cheap novel, printed in Manchir, he'd taken from the shelf, selecting page numbers, then lines down the page, then words in the lines. Langhorn 6:21:9, for example, directed him to the sixth page, the 21st line, and the 9th word. He tracked down each passage's indicated words, jotting each of them down quickly on a sheet of paper. Then he sat, gazing at the sheet for a moment, frowning, before he dropped it into the fire on his sitting room's hearth, stood, and crossed to the travelling cage. Its gilded bars were topped with ornamental finials, and he counted quickly around them from left to right until he got to the 13th. He gripped it, careful to keep his fingers out of reach of the wyvern's saw-toothed beaks, and twisted, but it wouldn't budge. "You've got stronger wrists than I do, Tobis," he said wryly. "See if you can get this thing to screw off. It turns clockwise to loosen, not counterclockwise." Raymond raised an eyebrow, then reached out. His powerful hand closed on the finial, and he grunted with effort. For a moment, nothing happened, then it yielded. Once it started turning, it went on turning easily, until he had screwed it completely off, revealing that the bar was hollow and contained two or three tightly rolled sheets of paper. "Well, well, well," Corris murmured, reaching in and extracting the sheets. He unrolled them and began to read, then stopped abruptly. His eyes widened in shock, and he looked quickly at Rayman. "My lord," the guardsman asked quickly. "It's just not from who I thought it would be from," Corris said.
"Is it bad news, then, my lord?"
"No, I wouldn't say that." Corris managed to smile, beginning to come back on balance with the practice of decades as a spymaster. It was, he admitted to himself, rather harder this time than it had ever been before. However, unexpected news, yes, but not bad. At least I don't think so. He looked back down at the note, trying to wrap his mind around all it implied. The handwriting in the correspondence was definitely Anvil Rock's, but if the note in his hand was to be believed, Anvil Rock had never written it, never even seen it, although exactly how the man who had written it and had the sheer audacity to personally deliver it to Tal'Kyra had managed to forge the correspondence so perfectly and gained access to the codebook Anvil Rock and Corris had arranged so long ago, were certainly interesting questions. "Earl Corris," it began. "First, I beg your pardon for a slight deception on my part. Two of them, to be more accurate. First, I've never actually met Captain Harry's, I'm afraid, nor has any portion of Prince Davin's gift ever been within 1,000 leagues of Coruscant. And second, I'm afraid my name isn't actually Abraham Zevons. It serves me well enough when needed, however, and while I'm aware you've never heard of me, I'm an associate of someone I'm certain you have heard of. Merlin Athroyes. I do the occasional odd job for Sajin Merlin when it would be impolitic for him to handle them himself.
and he asked me to deliver these wyverns to you as a gift from Duke Grey Harbour. I'm sure you've noticed they're a bit larger than most messenger wyverns, and there's a reason for that. You see...
2. Tellersburg Palace and Tellersburg Cathedral. City of Tellersburg, Kingdom of Old Caris.
God, it's good to be home, Charlian Armagh sighed, curling up against her husband's side and resting her head on his shoulder. She closed her eyes, feeling as if she were expanding the pores of her skin to absorb the gentle night breeze breathing through the bedchamber's open windows. Exotic insects, she hadn't heard in too many months, sang in the moon's silvered darkness. The brilliant stars of the southern hemisphere hung overhead like ornaments from some cosmic glassblower, and the part of her which had been missing for far too long was back beside her.
"So, Tellersburg is home now, is it?" Caleb teased gently, and she nodded. "At the moment, at least."
She raised her head long enough to kiss him on the cheek, then snuggled back down and wrapped one arm around his chest, all without ever opening her eyes again. "Don't let this go to your head, but home is wherever you are."
His own arm tightened around her and he pressed his cheek against the top of her head, inhaling the sweet scent of her hair and savouring its silken texture.
"Works both ways," he told her. "Except for me, home is wherever you and Alana are."
"Correction accepted, Your Majesty." "Thank you, Your Grace." Charlian giggled.
"What's so funny?" Caleb demanded. "You've got something against formality and courtesy?"
"Under most circumstances, no, I don't. But under these..."
Her hand slid down under the light thistle silk sheet covering them to the waist, and Caleb smiled.
"Courtesy is never wasted," he informed her. "I'm courteous to every naked lady I find in my bed. In fact..."
He broke off with a sudden twitch, and she raised her head from his shoulder to smile sweetly at him.
"I'd consider my next sentence very carefully if I were you," she said.
"Actually, my brain doesn't seem to be working very well at the moment," he replied, scooping her up and draping her diagonally across his body while he smiled up into her eyes. "I think this may be one of those moments when silence is golden."
The mood was rather different as the two of them headed for the council chamber they used as a working office whenever both of them happened to be in Tellersburg at the same time. Not the most exacting of their subjects, and not even the two of them, for that matter, could have demanded they give themselves over to official business the day before. Not after that same official business had separated the two of them for over 4 months. HMS Dawnstar's arrival in Tellersburg on yesterday afternoon's tide had been greeted even more tumultuously than Caleb's return from Chisholm. In some ways, the citizens of Old Caris had taken Charlian even more deeply to their hearts than Caleb. They loved both of them, but they adored her, which, as Caleb put it, indicated the soundness of their taste. And like the majority of their subjects, Carisian and Chisholmian alike, the citizens of Tellersburg were entranced by the deep and obvious love between the handsome young king and beautiful young queen who had married for reasons of state. Half the city had crowded the waterfront to watch Dawnstar being nudged gently up against the Royal Quay's pilings, and they had seen Emperor Caleb go bounding up the gangplank almost before the galleon was fully moored. And when he swept Empress Charlian up into his arms, tossed her over one shoulder, and carried her back down the gangplank while she laughed and whacked him on the back of his head, the entire huge crowd had erupted in cheers and whistles. Anyone who had suggested that the two of them should do anything besides take themselves off immediately to the palace would probably have been tarred and feathered on the spot. It had all been most improper, of course, as Charlian was well aware.
On the other hand, she didn't much care. And, on a more pragmatic note, she knew the short shrift she and Caleb often gave protocol and formal state occasions was part of the legend that made them not simply respected, but beloved by their subjects. She knew Duke Grey Harbour had also decided yesterday belonged to them, not to the Empire. But that had been then. This was now, and she wasn't looking forward to the news he had delayed giving them that first precious day. They reached the council chamber door, Merlin following at their heels, and Sergeant Seahamper saluted before he opened it for them and stood aside. Caleb smiled at the sergeant, resting one hand briefly on his shoulder, then escorted Charlianne into the chamber where the waiting ministers and councillors stood respectfully to greet them.
"Oh, sit back down," Caleb waved them back into their seats. "We can get all formal later, if we need to."
"Yes, Your Majesty, of course."
Grey Harbour managed to sound simultaneously patient, amused, and long-suffering, and Caleb made a face at him while he pulled Charlianne's chair back from the table and seated her. The first councillor smiled back, although there truly were times when he found Caleb's informality, even by Carisian standards, which were far more flexible than most, a little disconcerting. All in all, he vastly preferred it to the sort of ego-aggrandizing formality, bowing and scraping, with which too many monarchs, and far too many lesser nobles for that matter, in his opinion, surrounded themselves. It wasn't that he had any objection to the way in which Caleb and Charlianne handled themselves. It was that the part of him which looked to the future worried sometimes about the traditions they were establishing. The two of them had the strength of will, ability, and self-confidence, and the sheer charisma to handle their roles and responsibilities without taking refuge in strictly regulated, well-worn formality. But what happened when the Empire found itself ruled by someone without those strengths? Someone who wasn't able to laugh with his councillors without undermining his authority? Someone who lacked the confidence to pick up his wife in public or make jokes at his own expense in formal addresses to Parliament? Someone who couldn't allow herself to be scooped up without sacrificing one iota of her dignity when she needed it. Someone who lacked the focused sense of duty that prevented informality and tension-releasing humour from degenerating into license and frivolity. A kingdom was fortunate to have a single monarch of Caleb or Charlianne Armagh's calibre in a century. No realm could count on having two of them at the same time, still less on producing a third to follow in their footsteps. Indeed, much as Grey Harbour loved the baby crown princess, it had been his observation that the children of the towering rulers who dominated the history books had a distinct tendency to disappear in their parent shadows. And what soul could have the hardihood to stand in the shadow of rulers like these two, without feeling diminished, even angry, under the weight of their subjects' expectations? No wonder the heirs of so many great kings and queens had ended up giving their lives over to dissolution and sensuality.
"You must be feeling more confident about the outcome of this minor war of ours, if you're wasting time worrying about things like that, Regis," he told himself dryly. "Cheerful, too. Alana's just turned one, and you're already worrying about her having drunken orgies after her parents are gone, about the way the Empire's going to fall apart after them. Neither of them is 30 yet, for Langhorne's sake. It's not like you're going to be around for the transition."
No, he wasn't, God willing. But it was one of a first councillor's jobs to worry about things like that. Besides, he'd been making a conscious effort to stand back and consider the long view whenever he could. It was entirely too easy to get trapped up in the day-to-day concerns of simply surviving against an opponent the size of the Church of God awaiting. And when that happened, unhappy consequences could sneak up on someone.
and it also keeps you from thinking about what you're going to have to tell them on their very first full day together in almost 5 months, doesn't it? He asked himself grimly. Caleb sat in his own chair, laid his folded hands on the table in front of him, and glanced at Michael Stainer, sitting at its foot. Michael.
Of course, Your Majesty.
Stainer looked once around the table, then bent his head. O God, maker and keeper of the universe, author of all good things, our loving creator and father, bless these your servants, Caleb and Charlian, and all their advisers. Let us hear your voice and be guided by your counsel, and let our emperor's and empress' decisions be worthy of their responsibility to the subjects who are also your children, even as they are. Amen. No one seemed to notice the absence of any reference to the archangels, Caleb reflected, as he opened his eyes once more. Ever since he'd been elevated to archbishop, Stainer had focused even more directly upon every human being's personal relationship with God, rather than on the intermediary role of the archangels. By now, people scarcely noticed the subtle but deeply significant shift, and the majority of the Church of Caris's clergy seemed to be taking their own stance and practices directly from their archbishops. Michael always did think in terms of long-term strategy, didn't he? And speaking of long-term thinking, the Emperor looked directly across the table at Grey Harbour. Would you care to go ahead and share with us what you were sparing me and Charlie yesterday, Regis? He asked dryly. Your Majesty? Grey Harbour raised his eyebrows, and Caleb snorted.
I've known you since I was a boy, Regis. I don't want to get into anything about books and reading, but it was obvious to both me and Charlie that you had something on your mind yesterday. And since you didn't bring it up, it seemed equally obvious it had to be something you didn't think was going to make us happy.
The Emperor shook his head.
Trust me, we appreciate that. Still, it's a new morning, and we might as well get down to it.
Of course, Your Majesty.
Grey Harbour smiled involuntarily at Caleb's tone, but it was a fleeting smile, quickly faded, and he drew a deep breath and squared his shoulders.
I regret to inform you, Your Majesty, that we've received letters from Admiral Manthea. One contains a complete roster of the officers and men who surrendered to Duke Thirsk, and one of those who died in captivity after surrendering. It was very quiet and still, the humour of only a moment before fading as quickly as the Earl's smile. No one else spoke, and he looked steadily at his monarchs as he continued. There's also Sir Gwilym's formal report. It's very brief. He had none of his logs or records to consult when he prepared it, and for reasons his other letters make clear, very little time in which to write it. It confirms most of what we already knew and suspected about his final engagement, and also something we've all feared. Grey Harbour's eyes flitted briefly aside to Captain Athroise, standing just inside the council chamber's door. He'd been taking Merlin's visions into his calculations for years now, and not everyone in the chamber was cleared for that information. And, of course, Merlin had been away from Tellisburg for the better part of a year, during which he'd been unable to provide any updated reports on Gwilym Manthir's situation. King Ranild has formally surrendered custody of Sir Gwilym and all of his officers and men to the Inquisition. The Earl's voice was flat and harsh now. They left Gorath overland for Zion either late in May or in the first 5 day of June. Given the length of the journey and the quality of mainland roads, they must have already reached the temple.